Rohan Nadkarni of Sports Illustrated joins me to discuss Ja Morant's season-ending injury and the fourth best team in each conference, including the worst good player in the NBA. Now, who could that be? All that and more coming up on this episode of Divine Intervention. Listen, someone's going to win. F*** it. Might as well be you. John Gennaro, count me in! Today's first words belong to my dear friend Shay Serrano, multimedia mogul, but most importantly also guest on No Cap Room. But the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get started, here are three things I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and to talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, the return to my life of Frog and Toad. My older daughter loved reading Frog and Toad stories, but then she got a little older and started gravitating toward older kid stuff. But now my younger kid is getting into Frog and Toad. She's more confident with reading out loud, and that means the boys are back in my life, which you love to see. Stories about friendship and cookies and dreams and then more friendship. And number three, just as important as all of that, I get to spend part of my morning with somebody whose work I enjoy, whose presence I appreciate, and whose effervescence I find to be a true delight. My guest today is a fantastic writer whose coverage has appeared in the Miami Herald, on GQ.com, and on Deadspin, the old version. These days, he covers the NBA for Sports Illustrated, serving as one of the hosts to the Crossover, SI's NBA podcast, and profiling as perhaps the hardest working, best conditioned, most professional, unselfish, toughest, meanest, nastiest staff writer in the game today. Friends, a warm welcome for Rohan Nadkarni. Rohan, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Dan. I really appreciate you having me on. I was getting nervous because I saw how many guests you were having on this podcast, and I was like, oh my God, am I going to get the call up? What's going on here? So, I finally made it. I'm thrilled to be here. Really excited to talk basketball with you, buddy.
Well, I mean, there were certain obligations I had to get in. You got in ahead of Jake. That's the most important thing.
Okay,
Jake
has been, that's great. Yes,
he's been begging to get on the show, and I can't have it. And I got to have the guest list is a highly critical thing. Don't tell him I said this. He won't listen. He won't hear it. Don't worry about it. But I'm very glad to have you on the show, especially because today I wanted to talk through, like, I've talked about or written about just about all the teams at the top of the standings. And there's this like really interesting clump in both conferences of teams right below that top tier. And I kind of wanted to pick through them, talk about a few of them, back and forth. And as someone who I know has the range. You have the range, Rohan. That's really what I wanted to focus on today. I really wanted you to come on for a conversation like this, and I'm so glad to have you here today. And we will get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate first from a place of joy. So, Rohan, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
I would say the Boston Celtics losing last night brought me a lot of joy, particularly in such a way that they got so upset about the call at the end of the game. And, I love when it comes out. I love when they can't hide it. And I love when they're, people are like, of course that was a foul. All these.
I was going to say, what's it? What is it that you love to see it come out?
It's when the quote unquote objective reporters who are, the basketball heads who watch every game, but then just something happens with the Celtics and they just cannot help but to complain about it and be like, are you kidding me? We got hosed. So that brought me a lot of joy. I was going to mention how fun it was watching that Grizzlies-Lakers game last weekend, and how fun that was, except the Grizzlies are kind of back to being sad again. But I would say those are a couple of things that have brought me some joy over the last week.
Well, okay. It's important and strong to emphasize the Boston media mafia's brief meltdowns. We certainly enjoy that. We love to hear that. And you're absolutely right. You got to transition. We're going to transition to the Grizzlies because sadly it is not all joy this morning or today. We have to make a little bit of room to talk about a pretty big bummer. The Memphis Grizzlies announced on Monday night that Ja Morant will undergo season-ending surgery on his right shoulder. After scoring 21 points with 7 rebounds and 7 assists in a big Grizzlies win on Friday against the Lakers, as you mentioned, all-star point guard sustained an injury during a team training session on Saturday, kept him out of Sunday's win against the Suns. Sub- subsequent MRI revealed an underlying labral tear that's going to put him under the knife and bring a disappointingly premature end to Ja Morant's 2023-24 season, just 9 games after he returned from his 25-game suspension for multiple instances of brandishing firearms on social media. Your immediate reaction to hearing the news Monday night, Rohan, I know you had been, as you mentioned, you were psyched about watching them against the Lakers there. What was your sort of first blush reaction to the news for Monday night?
Okay, not to make light of this, but my first reaction was, and this is something that's become a little bit, I would say, a pet cause of mine, is the way NBA teams talk about injuries now. It's like someone started doing a bit, and now they're all doing a bit. It's like he okay. suffered a subluxation or something like that of his yes. shoulder in a training session. I'm sorry, what? What is that word? What is this subluxation? Whatever happened to tear, sprain, and strain? That was the only three things that existed for like the first 25, 26 years of my life. And then all of a sudden it's like, this guy's got, what was it with CJ McCollum? What did he have like the, in his lung? It was like he had a hole in his lung or something, but they were like, they were like, he's got some long word of the lung. And I'm like, when did we all agree that we knew what this term was? That this is like common part, like layman's, what is it? You got it?
I wanted to look it up because I wasn't sure. It was a small pneumothorax in his right lung, which I had to Google and then found out that it was a partially collapsed lung. Yeah.
And everyone was tweeting it. Everyone's like, CJ McCollum's got small pneumothorax. And I'm like, what? When did we all learn about that?
That sounds disrespectful. Let's be kind.
Yeah. So that was my true, honest first reaction. I was like, what? Just speak English, please. Look, man, obviously it's a massive bummer. You know, I wrote a short reaction piece for this on SI. You know, they were balling. They were hooping since Ja got back, 6-3 with him in the lineup, and gave me like that small bit of hope that maybe they can make a run and salvage the season. I think for me, I look at it, it's like, listen, their big goal this year, just let Jaren Jackson Jr., Desmond Bane get through the season healthy. You can't tax them. You can't overtax them. You're already in a huge role. Don't Don't push it. But beyond that, like, you don't have to panic. Like I saw, you know, NBA Twitter is already like, who are they trading Marcus Smart to? You don't need to tear down this roster. If anything, add to it. Continue adding to it. And I hope you get a good lottery pick, because they could use that kind of player or that kind of draft pick to blow this team out moving forward. So I do think there will be some a long-term benefit maybe, but for right now, they just kind of have to make sure they don't sustain any more losses.
Yeah, and that's, I think you're absolutely right to note that they don't have to make any sort of rash decisions or any mm-hmm. big long-range moves. They have Ja Morant and Desmond Bane and Jaren Jackson Jr. and Marcus Smart all under contract through at least the end of next season, like a couple of seasons out. So they've got an opportunity, they've got runway to kind of get everybody healthy. You know, Brandon Clark, there was a question when we talked about the Grizzlies with Chris Harrington a couple weeks ago, like, is he done for the season? Is he not done for the season? Are they going to try to rush him back? You know, if they're in the midst of going for the play-in, like maybe they try to get him back on the court a little earlier. No reason to do any of that now. You've got the, you know, 4, 5, 6 most important pieces of your team, arguably all under contract moving forward. Like, you can take your time. And then, as you know, our friend Tom Ziller noted in his Good Morning It's Basketball newsletter today, one of the silver linings here is they're in all likelihood going to be getting a high draft pick out of this. You know, as it stands now, 6th worst record in the league at 13-23, which checked on Tankathon this morning, would give him about a 40% chance at a top 4 pick and a 9% chance of first overall. Even if you don't get those like high upside outcomes, you add another like mid lottery pick to that core you've got. Gives you another bite at the apple where, you know, you were unsuccessful at, or have been thus far unsuccessful at turning Zaire Williams into a high-end player, or, you know, like you're churning through the Jake LaRavias and David Roddy's and trying to sort of figure out who else might fit with that group. This gives you another crack at that. So yeah, like there are silver linings to it in the longer range, but still obviously a pretty, you know, a significant blow considering they like just got back to fun. And you know, we hope for a full recovery for Ja, and for that matter, you know, Steven Adams and Brandon Clark, like that Grizzlies team at full strength is one of my favorite watches in the league. So hope we get to see them like that again soon.
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun watching their games the last couple of weeks, especially because they've had to play with a playoff level of intensity because they can't afford to lose a single game. That's been really exciting to watch. I do think the draft pick thing here is going to be key, because if they could get like a Christian Brown type, one of those plug and play rookies, someone who can enter their rotation right away, that would help them a lot. I mean, the Laravias, the guys you mentioned, Roddy, Aldama, they have solid role players, but I think that they're a little bit flawed. So, you know, finding someone who can enter their rotation right away, they you know, have an opportunity to trade that pick, I do think long-term will be beneficial for them.
And could absolutely, you know, help them vault kind of right back into the competitive mix they've been in the last couple of seasons, where they're vying for top four seeds, they're vying for home court advantage, and trying to make deep playoff runs, which kind of brings me to the conversation I wanted to have with you today. Entering Tuesday night's games, there's six teams in the league with a winning percentage of 650 or better. Three in each conference. There's the aforementioned Boston Celtics, joined with the Milwaukee Bucks and the Philadelphia 76ers in the East. There's the Minnesota Timberwolves, the Denver Nuggets, and the Oklahoma City Thunder in the West. So all of those teams kind of have established themselves as the classes of their respective conferences. Mm-hmm. And they've got, you know, there's things we can poke at and pick at with them, but they're head and shoulders kind of above the rest of the teams beneath them. But then there is that big group of teams beneath them, like all of them scrambling for the last home court advantage spot and staying out of the play-in. They're all tightly bunched together. You've got the Heat, Magic, Pacers, Cavs, and Knicks in the East, and the Clippers, Kings, Mavs, and Pelicans in the West. You could also throw in the Suns and the Rockets there. They're a couple games back, but over 500 in that mix, a few games out. And so, like, there's a ton of competition. Obviously, there's also, you know, the Lakers and the Warriors that are further down, but, you know, we've talked enough about them for a lot of it. We can leave those aside for a second. There's this group of, you know, sort of like the second tier in each conference. I'm wondering, the ones that are all sort of vying for fourth place, which of those teams, you know, we can go pick whichever one you want. One of those teams that's sort of most interesting to you, and, you know, why?
Is it too obvious to say the Clippers? Like, do you want to talk about the Clippers right away, or do you want me to go with one of my other picks?
No, listen, I this show is nothing if not obvious, and there's no points for cleverness. So yes, by all means, let's go with the Clippers. That's totally fine by me. What about them strikes you?
I mean, look, they've obviously been on a tear recently. They kind of feel, after the first five-game losing streak with James Harden in the lineup, moving Russ to the bench, they've really seemed to figure it out. Kawhi Leonard is back to being Kawhi Leonard, and I think when Kawhi is playing at the level he's played this season, I know he's been on a minutes restriction the last couple games, and, you know, maybe the injury thing is creeping up for some people, but the fact that he's played in a vast majority of games, they haven't been doing like that, he can't play back-to-backs, all this kind of stuff. He's the one guy that when he's like fully Kawhi, I'm confident like can be better than Jokic for an entirety of a playoff series. In a way that I think I'm even more confident in him than Giannis, which I know sounds crazy. I mean, Giannis has not been bad this season by any stretch. Like, I have him in my top five of my fake MVP ballot that I do every week. But there's just something about when Kawhi's playing like this, man, he feels like truly like he can be the best player on the floor, or the best player in the world, which I think is an important distinction. Yeah, man, they're scary. You know, you mentioned those teams like the Thunder and Wolves, who have obviously been great. The fact that they don't have the experience, to me, the Clippers are the Nuggets' biggest threat in the West right now.
I can see that, especially because now you're talking, you're absolutely right. If you have the fully operational Kawhi, like, there was that moment at the beginning of last postseason where they take on the Suns, and it's like, oh no, okay, he's across the aisle from Kevin Durant and Devin Booker and looking like he's ready to be the best player in this series, which is crazy. And then obviously the, you know, injury bug bites again. But you're absolutely right. Like, the beginning of that, of this season, there was like, you know, does he not have the separation? Can he not get the burst? You know, whatever it is. And then the last, you know, month and a half, couple months, he has looked absolutely sensational right up until he gets that hip contusion that knocks him out for a few games, but then comes back from that looking strong too. And like, when he's the organizing principle and the thing that the Clippers kind of stake the entire franchise on, and everything else can revolve around him, they can absolutely beat anybody in the league. And I think the thing that's been most interesting over these last couple of months, as you mentioned, since the lineup change to move Russ to the bench and sort of reorient everything, Terrence Mann goes into that spot and everything runs through Harden a little bit more. It's that James Harden, it's almost like we forgot the way things started off in Brooklyn and in Philadelphia.
All the time, yes.
It's like, like he comes in and there's that sort of soundbite quote of, you know, like, I'm not a system player. I am the system. I am a system. And we all start thinking like, oh, well, here we go. He's going to try to dominate the ball and run everything. It's like, no, like he made those other teams into the best offense in the league by being the point guard that orchestrated everything and organized everything. And what has this Clippers team been crying out for the last couple of years, if not a guy who can do that and like make it so that Kawhi Leonard and Paul George don't have to create like 70% of their own buckets. So, I mean, the caveats are all going to be there. You know, the Clippers are the classic team of like, wake me up in the in April, May, and June, and like, let's see what it is there. But you're absolutely, I mean, if that is the, you know, multi-billion dollar question, if they can get this Kawhi to that part of the calendar, I think you're absolutely right to say like, that is a terrifying proposition for anybody up at the top of the Western Conference standings. And then, you know, the potential cosmic, you know, clash of, can the Clippers stay healthy, and then James Harden in elimination games in the playoffs, the karma of all of that could absolutely be just devastating.
Remember when there was like the brief discussion when Harden after Harden got to Brooklyn, and it was like, can he still win MVP after tanking the Rockets? Like, that's how good he was his first year in Brooklyn. And that team, again, I mean, the things that went wrong for them in that series against the Bucks, they were blowing the Bucks off the floor when they were healthy. And like, maybe the most impressed I ever was with Harden in an elimination game was when he played that game 7 on a clearly bum hamstring.
He was on one leg.
Yeah, and he was fantastic that first year in Brooklyn. And I think like when I wrote about the trade grade, when I wrote like trade grades for SI about this Harden deal, like the one thing I said is like, if they get Brooklyn Harden, they're cooking. Like, they're cooking with something there. And that's what it's been so far, man. And I think like him and Russ, I haven't looked at the stats too recently, but like after they moved him to the bench, like Harden and Russ went from playing something like 18 minutes together a night to 9 minutes together a night. They staggered the rotation really well. Tice has actually been giving them really good backup minutes to the point where even Mason Plumlee's like, I don't need to rock the boat. They're going to have options to be flexible in the playoffs. Like, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's going to come down to, can they get this version of Kawhi when it matters most? Unfortunately, we have not seen it in many, many years. But if they do, I mean, I'm not one of those people that's going to be like, well, they're not going to do it because everyone's going to get hurt. Like, that's no fun. So I feel pretty good about their chances of making conference finals as presently constructed.
And be given this massive run they've been on right now, they are now only 2.5 games out of first place. They're, you know, a couple games back of Denver. Those top three teams are tightly packed together, but the Clippers are absolutely rolling and could factor into not just that, like, who's your fourth conversation, mm-hmm. but even higher up the standings. The one that I wanted to hit on from the West, or at least the first one I wanted to hit on from the West, is a team that I am like very much a Lucy, Charlie Brown sees Lucy with the football kind of person for this team. And that's the Pelicans. Mm-hmm. They are 22-15. They famously sort of got absolutely dismantled in front of God and everybody in the in-season tournament by the Lakers. And which turned into a referendum on Zion Williamson's fitness, the level of dog that's in him. Could he be the guy? Is this team like fundamentally broken? Whatever else. And then since that, all they've done is go 10-4 with the best net rating in the league to move up into that mix for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, that sort of cluster, all four games back of Minnesota. And I find myself watching them and thinking like, well, they finally have like everybody healthy. You know, CJ McCollum's back from the small pneumothorax. Zion Williamson's been on the court. Him, Brandon Ingram, and CJ McCollum, the three of them together have played just in this past month more minutes together than they had like the entirety of the last two seasons, because they just could never get those guys on the court at the same time. They're finally starting to build some of that chemistry, and you're seeing like a little bit more of, you know, Brandon Ingram, Zion pick and roll, and like CJ spotting up in the corner off that action. And if you help off him, there's an easy kick out. Like, they're learning how to play together with the kind of depth that they've gotten, in a way that makes me wonder, like, if you get that team, like that level of depth, that level of top end talent, could they be a monster problem for any of these teams in the West? But like, Rohan, am I looking at this through like rose-colored glasses when it comes to these guys? Like, if I had too many grenades on Bourbon Street, what is the most likely, or where do you see them sort of netting out with this collection of talent in New Orleans?
I don't think you're off base here at all for a couple reasons. One, I mean, we all have fond memories of that first round series against the Suns a couple years ago and what they were able to do, and that was without Zion. And what's interesting is Zion's had, you could argue, maybe like his worst season as a pro. Like, his points per game are way down. It's kind of finishing is down a little bit. The usage, all those things. But I think in turn with that, like, Brandon Ingram's been their best player, and in a way that's been good for them. He's looked really good. CJ's healthy. You mentioned the depth. They have a better net rating than the Bucks right now. You know, they're not that far.
Which is nuts.
Yeah, it's nuts. and like, comfortably so. Let me pull it up real quick. Like, you know, they have a 4.4 net rating. Milwaukee's 3.9. I mean, they're almost as close to 6 as they are to 8. Like, this is a good team. This has been a really good team. And they have the pieces, I think, to bother other teams in the West in a playoff series. I mean, they had a game against the Nuggets a couple weeks ago. I'm like, not even able to remember who won right now, because I'm like, but they were going blow for blow with the Nuggets down the stretch of that game. I think that was the one that – I don't remember if that was – no, the Pelicans were – Grizzlies one is the one that went to overtime. I'm rambling like a crazy person right now. My point being,
it's okay.
They can compete right with the best on a given night. And if they got a team like OKC or Minnesota in the first round, like, I think that's a toss-up series at this point. Like, that's how much faith I have in the Pelicans when everything is clicking. And you're right, there's so much like outsized attention on Zion, and is he meeting expectations, and can he be the guy we thought he was going to be? Where's the explosiveness? That since then, they've just been a good team, and that's been more important. So they're very interesting, man. I think Willie Green is a fantastic coach. I think he's done such a great job there. Like, every time there's adversity, he seems to be able to get the most out of that group. I mean, they were first place, you know, in December last year until injuries really derailed it. So they're kind of having the opposite right now, where they're getting healthy later in the season. I mean, are you like, how confident would you be in Minnesota, for example? As great as Minnesota's been, as awesome as Ant has been, like, I don't think they're beating the Pelicans in 5 in the first round or something like that, you know?
Yeah, especially considering, I think the games that I was focusing on most recently with them is like, they beat Minnesota twice just mm-hmm. recently. Like, that was the thing. Like, they've beaten up on a lot of sort of weaker teams in this, you know, post in season tournament run. But those are the ones that kind of made you stand up and notice, like, all right, Zion is going at Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns and whoever else, like, with zero fear for, you know, whether those guys can keep him away from the rim. And that's a situation where, like, if you are a Minnesota team that plays big and huge all the time, but the other guys can play huge with you, with Zion being like totally unafraid to go to the basket relentlessly, and Jonas Valanciunas being a bear that you got to deal with there, and the offensive glass and enough shooting and spacing around them, like, that's it, they can really cause problems. And I think a really important player getting him back healthy was Trey Murphy III for them, where it's like, it just affords more flexibility in how they build their lineups. Like, it's not, he's the kind of player that you can put out there and not have to worry about the trade-off mm-hmm. necessarily of like, Jordan Hawkins will shoot a ton, but he can't really play defense yet. Or Herb Jones can defend everybody, but he's a little bit inconsistent from, you know, shooting from the corners, and you've got to, maybe defenses can sag off him. Trey Murphy kind of allows you to split the difference. And then if you're playing, like, you can downsize if you need to and go like Zion at center, Ingram, Trey Murphy, mm-hmm. Herb, and CJ. Like, there's a lot of more lineup flexibility. You need somebody to stick on like a hot perimeter player. Dyson Daniels has had some really good minutes for them as a defender. Like, there's a lot of answers. And you bring up Willie Green as somebody who's been a really important piece for them. I think they were 6th in defensive efficiency last year. They're right back around there right now. And the question is more like, to me, it's not like, can Willie Green get the best out of this team? It's going to be more like, you know, you mentioned that Memphis game, and it was Herb isolate, you know, a one-on-one yes. ISO defense on Ja, and Ja had been absolutely crushing him and like just torching him. And Willie Green just stuck with it and didn't try something else or throw a second guy at him. And, you know, that's not to say that, like, Willie Green doesn't understand that you should probably double team the ball out of a really good offensive player's hands. It's just, those are the kind of questions where it's like, you've got all these potential answers, like a full menu in front of you, which ones are you going to pick and which buttons are you going to push to kind of try to get the most out of them in the context of a given game or in crunch time, which is one of the only areas where the Pelicans have really struggled this season. They've been below average in crunch time.
Sorry, not to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Just their offense in crunch time is like, it's fascinating. I don't know if you feel the same way. Like, isn't it kind of shocking how much further they are defensively than offensively?
Especially with a lot of young guys on that team. And then like the veterans that they've got are not, elite defensive players. So, yeah, I mean, Willie Green getting that much buy-in and getting that level of execution across the board has been awesome for them. But yeah, you'd say like, given the offensive talent, you'd like to see better execution and more production in crunch time. And maybe some of that just does go back to, you haven't had a whole lot of Zion and Brandon Ingram and CJ McCollum all together. Yeah. And like you're starting to get some of that familiarity, some of those reps, a better understanding of how to space the floor with those guys. And, when a team sends a second defender at Zion or tries to collapse in the paint, where the kickouts are, more reps with that, more health, better opportunities could, lead to better results. But I think that is one of those, we're going to need to see it with these guys in big games against really good teams later on in the season. The hope is just like, can we actually get them there?
By the way, just so people understand, I'm not like the, the meme of like the grandma on the walker and like her granddaughter's helping her walk. And it's like, sure, grandma.
Yes.
The game I was talking about apparently happened in November. I thought it was like 2 weeks ago, but they beat the Nuggets 115-110. Jamal Murray was out, but like they got enough stops down the stretch of that game. Like beating the Nuggets in a close fourth quarter game goes so far for me because of how dominant Jokic is in those situations. So like they can compete, man. That's a great pick. And I just hope they get back into the playoffs because that Suns series, I hate when it's like a team like that or a series like that. It's like, it's so fragile and it can get forgotten to history and forgotten to time so quickly, but there was so much excitement around the team after that. That was when like Jose Alvarado like really splashed onto the scene. And
yeah,
I just want that again. Like, and I think we're going to get it this year. I really do.
Well, fingers crossed for that. But Rohan, give me another team. You got someone in the East that you like in this sort of conversation? Somebody that interests you from the East?
I think I'm not trying to pander, but I think we have to talk about the Knicks post Anunoby trade, man. I mean, in all seriousness, like they smack. Can I say a bad word on here?
Of course, you can. Say more. Say a bunch of them.
They smacked the shit out of Philly, man. I mean, they embarrassed Philly on their home floor to the point where like people were criticizing Embiid for stat padding in a blowout.
Yes.
That was a really impressive win.
That 30-10 streak, man. 30-10 streak is a huge deal, apparently.
I love another thing I love is just when people just subtly take shots at Embiid here. Or not so subtly, but the Knicks have been on a little bit of a roll here. And I want to ask you where you are on the Julius Randle experience, because I feel like he's going through another one of his hot stretches right now. Let's see, they've won 4 in a row now. They had a win against Minnesota, which was really nice. You know, they beat up on the Wizards, whatever, everyone beats up on the Wizards, but they've been good this year, and it's another team that I think, if you could go at least net rating-wise, there's a little bit of a separation between them and some of these other teams we're talking about in this cohort, right? Like, net rating-wise, at least they're way ahead of Miami, Cleveland, Indiana. So, they're not way ahead of Indiana, but healthy amount. So, I kind of like the Knicks, and I think that what's funny is, like, they don't even need Anunoby to be, like, a 20-point-per-game scorer as much as if he's providing all this space for Brunson and Randle to cook, I think that's already making a difference. So, yeah, I'm curious where you are on this team and Randle specifically, because he's another guy that's like, we've seen him have big regular seasons before, but does it translate to the postseason?
Yeah, I have a large emotional investment in the Julius Randle story. No financial investment, let's be clear about that, but an emotional investment in this, because I think like, and I wrote about this a little bit when we did the Christmas Day slate, and I had like most interesting players of the day there. And Randle was my pick in the Bucks-Knicks game because I think he's like the least respected, very good player in the league.
Yes.
Like he's made two All-NBA teams in the last 3 years, and it's kind of like, yeah, but not really.
I think like a non-Knicks fan would say he's the worst good player in the NBA, like, right? Which is like a weird distinction.
That's the thing. And going through, like, I went through the list of like who's made multiple All-NBA teams in the last, you know, 3-4 years. And yeah, like even objectively looking at that, I'm like, well, yeah, he's not like those guys. But then he like did make the list. And then, you know, he had the brutal start to this season where he's ice cold, can't make a shot the first, you know, couple of weeks of the season. But the last 30 games, he's up over 26 points, 9 rebounds, and 4.5 assists a game, shooting 51% from the field. Like, he's, if he doesn't make the All-Star team, I mean, maybe he won't because it's a crowded field, but he's certainly going to be back in that mix. And he's certainly back in the, you know, the broader conversation of, you know, is he an All-NBA forward again? I think you're right to note one of the sort of nice side benefits of the OG Anunoby trade is he's a more consistent and more dangerous corner shooter than RJ Barrett was. And so teams have to load up a little bit different, or can't load up as much defensively on, you know, either Randall pick and rolls or Brunson isolations. And so that just, it's given them more room where, you know, Randall's our usage rate has actually gone up since OG Anunoby got there. OG Anunoby's taken like 7 shots a game, but the offense has been really good with them on the floor. And so I think that they like, there is, Randall is another one of those, you know, I mentioned it with Harden and mentioned it with all these teams that we're talking about. We have seen him struggle mightily in the playoffs. He absolutely folded up in the Atlanta series a couple of years ago. There's maybe some caveats in the Miami, or the way he performed against Cleveland and Miami in the postseason, because he was dealing with that ankle injury that he suffered late last season. And so like he kind of rushed back from that and re-aggravated it in the Cleveland series. So you can say, you could take that with a grain of salt. But you need to see him when the Knicks get back to the playoffs this season. Like, if he does not have a respectable showing in, you know, a round or two of the playoffs this season, then all of the, you know, doom and gloom and concern is going to sort of, the clouds are going to get even darker over the Garden there. But I think to this point, you look at what they've been, and it's one of those things I feel like I don't totally buy it. It's one of the disconnects between eye test and math a little bit. But, you know, like a site like Dunks and Threes, where their adjusted net rating takes into account like how good of a schedule you play, like how good the offenses you've dealt with, how good of the defenses that you've dealt with, it consistently spits back the Knicks as like maybe the third best team in the East, and like maybe like on par, like maybe better than, or like, you know, possession by possession or whatever, better than the Bucks. And I don't buy that because I've seen the Bucks take care of them a few times, but it's sort of like, Maybe they are like consistently or legitimately in that 3-4 conversation. As Randall goes, so go goes the team. And I think that's a scary proposition for a Knicks fan in a playoff series.
I mean, listen, it's high risk, high reward. I do think that like come playoff time, I'd just like to see him do a significantly less amount of the Randall isolations that I'm sure drive you crazy on some level. And obviously, again, he's been very successful with it in the regular season, but like in that Heat series especially, it's like get some screens going, get some post-ups going. Like, it was so much isolation on the wing and staring at 4 defenders that, you know, hopefully we don't get as much of that in the playoffs. But I'm with you. I mean, Milwaukee's in the top three. I'm sure you've discussed them a lot. I mean, they got shellacked last night, and that was even with Damian Lillard not playing. People thought maybe that would improve their defense. Not ended up being the case, so They have their issues, and I think the Knicks are in a position to capitalize.
Yeah, that I had pitched writing about, or, you know, checking back in on the Bucks defense. Not going to do that this week. Maybe that's something I look at. The fact that Giannis is basically every game saying like, we have no pride on defense, like that seems like a bad sign that they continue to get roasted and destroyed. And then after every game, he's like, yeah, no, we should be booed. I would be booing us. We have no pride. Everyone needs to be better, including the equipment manager. And like maybe a shift in tactics or in personnel would be better. Might be in the offing there. But, you know, TBD, we'll get back to that. To your point, I just want to note, like, Fred Katz at The Athletic does a great job covering the Knicks, and the Knicks beat wrote a piece that I went up, I believe, yesterday on Randall shifting a little bit more toward pick and rolls, as you mentioned, like more of him in action, you know, playing with another teammate, allowing him to use his, you know, his passing, his court vision, not just sort of like trying to barrel into three defenders. It's been an important shift for him, has helped, you know, unlock the Knicks offense a little bit. So, and actually you mentioned, it's funny, you come on this show and you say like, I don't want to pander. The team I want to talk about is the one that you talk about a lot, is the Miami Heat. So here's the table setting. Mm-hmm. The Heat are plus 38 for the season in 36 games. So like plus 1 point per game for the season.
They have a middling, they're cleaning like 16th in net rating or something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say cleaning the glass, which strips out garbage time stuff, has them at 18th on offense and 13th on defense. Jimmy has missed 12 games. Bam Adebayo has missed 10 games. Tyler Hero missed 18 games. Important guys like Caleb Martin and Haywood Highsmith have missed a ton of time. Jimmy, Bam, and Hero have only played about 150 minutes together all season, and they're 21-15. So, like, what the hell is going on?
This is where I think I'm gonna swerve a little bit. I'm not high on this Heat team, and I frankly think like they're due for a little bit of a reality check, and we'll get there in a second. Listen, Eric Spoelstra is an incredible coach. You know, they lost to the Clippers like last week, and someone was trying to ask about Jimmy Butler after the game, and he's like, I don't care about that. And like almost immediately, like they course corrected their defense. They played a really good game against the Rockets on Monday night, got a win. You know, not a great road team, but good offensive performance without Jimmy. You know, obviously everyone's losing their minds about Hawkes. He's been great for them. Just like a immediate plug and play rotation guy who's been incredibly important to what they're doing, getting insane contributions from Kevin Love. It remains baffling that he couldn't find a spot in Cleveland's rotation last year because he's been an absolute godsend for the Heat. So I think regular season, they've been fantastic. Eric Spoelstra, as we know, is a wizard. There's kind of just like a running joke where it's like, I think everyone in Miami believes that Spo enjoys his job more the more people are injured. It's like that's when he can really get in the lab. That's when he's like, oh, you're giving me like six NBA players, a G Leaguer, and Udonis Haslem. Like, okay, we're going to run a zone and hold this team to like 18% from three and, you know, take 56 by ourselves. And so I think they're actually a better regular season team than they were last year, in large part because of guys having Hawkes, Love, Highsmith. They're a better regular season team than last year. But this idea to me that like, oh, Boston's scared to see the Heat in the playoffs. Have you watched the Celtics this year? Like that is a juggernaut, a two-way juggernaut that is one of the best offenses in the league, one of the best defenses in the league. Like, you know, a lot of people were like, well, we've barely seen Bam, Hero, and Jimmy play together this year. It's like, well, we have seen them play together a lot. You know, it's not like when they play, this team lights the world on fire in the regular season. Like, so I'm kind of like lower on this team than most people. And as you know, I'm a huge fan of Jimmy Butler. I think he's incredible. And what he's done in the playoffs the last couple of years has been spectacular. But they've made life, I think, difficult for him. And people just, in some ways, like this finals run that they went on just allows anyone to say now, like, regular season doesn't matter. Like, we'll sprinkle some culture on it when we get to the playoffs. And I just don't think that's a viable strategy. You know, the bubble is weird because the bubble, I have a ton of respect for the teams that made it deep in the bubble. I'm not saying it was easy, but we can agree it was a unique circumstance. Yes. And we can agree that the Heat making it to the playoffs as an 8 seed, it's like, I'm not going to start betting on 8 seeds to make the finals now. You know what I mean? So
sure.
This idea that the regular season doesn't matter, I don't know. I just think that, you look at the Heat's biggest competition in the East, the Sixers, the Bucks, and the Celtics. They all made moves, whether by addition or subtraction, that made their teams a lot better in a way that, like, this idea to me that, like, they'd be scared of Miami, I don't buy it.
I get that, and I think that's fair. I think all of the teams at that level are it's more about, like, it's matchups obviously matter a ton, but it's also, like, are we going to be able to get to our best selves? That matters more than, you know, necessarily who's on the other side of the court from us. But I do think that Miami represents, if not like a boogeyman for those teams, at least a problem because as you mentioned, it's sort of a deeper Heat team mm-hmm. this year than even last year's version. And there's also been just individual development. I know you wrote about Duncan Robinson becoming like all of a sudden a guy who puts it on the floor mm-hmm. and that averages like 4 assists per 36 minutes. Like guys are, it's not just the same team with like Jaime Jaquez Jr., although it's nice to have him. The guys are also getting better. Like right. Bam has been, you know, getting to the line more, working out of the post more. Like there's like more variety in his offensive game. Tyler Hero, you know, back healthy after missing almost all the postseason last year, like has the motivation, especially to say like, I maybe shouldn't be the one who's dangled in every trade conversation and I can be a significant impact player in terms of how we win. Kyle Lowry, who is like the most frequently dangled outside of Tyler Hero, I guess, like because he's the $29 million expiring contract. It's like, yeah, he's also hitting like 43% of his threes and, you know, like a handful of assists a game, hardly ever turns the ball over and is able to like be that in tight spaces. I make the right pass that unlocks, you right. know, five jab steps for Jaquez or Jimmy or whoever to get to the bucket. Like they've found ways to like safe crack their, you know, the offense when they need to. And they've got a ton of talent that can bear out the Kevin Love thing. I want to just briefly highlight that if people have not been paying a ton of attention to what he's doing there, like if you need to juice the offense when Bam needs a breather, like they've been slotting Kevin Love in as a stretch five and going five out. And they're scoring like on top of the Pacers level offensive yeah. efficiency with Kevin Love at the five. It's crazy. He's having his highest true shooting percentage since the last time he made the All-Star team in Cleveland. Win shares per 48 minutes, highest since he was in Minnesota a decade ago. So like those advanced stats don't necessarily, you know, that you could take them all with a grain of salt, but when they're all pointing toward this guy's having a massive impact on winning for this team, that, you know, maybe you take notice of that irrespective of the salt and pepper in his hair.
Kevin Love's been unbelievable for them. I'm looking it up right now on Cleaning the Glass. He's played 66% of his minutes at center this year. The Heat are a plus 12 points per 100 when he's at center with a 129.0 offensive rating, which is just, as you mentioned, absurd. I do think it's interesting because I think all their role players have done about as much as you could ask from them this year. You mentioned Lowry, like he's not a $30 million a year player, but he's been really solid. Duncan, I would take this team more seriously if they made a move. And it's been a long time since the Heat made a move that got them like a little bit better as opposed to taking a home run swing. So if that means getting a guy like Terry Rozier, I've been like pounding the table. Like they got to get like a Bojan Bogdanovic. And those aren't sexy names, but they do things that the Heat need. They can get to the rim. Like they have nobody on this team who's really taking shots at the rim and connecting at a good rate. Like Bam takes the most shots at the rim and you expect that. I mean, he plays center. He plays closer to the hoop. There are elements they need to add to their offense that players who aren't necessarily the biggest names could add to it. And I think make a significant impact for them. But yeah, I last year obviously looms large. And I feel like there's this new thing now where like nobody wants to look like an idiot for writing them off. And I'm certainly not writing them off. But I do think they're a move away. And, you know, like how can you in good faith put the Heat over the Knicks, for example, based on nothing other than like, I'm too scared based on like the past, you know, and
Rohan, I'm sniffing out what you're doing.
No. I promise you, it's not one of those things.
It's an emotional hedge.
No, it's not
you're
emotional
to
hedge.
Put the pressure on me on my own goddamn show.
I'm trying
show.
To put the pressure on the Heat to make life easier for Jimmy Butler. Because what it is I just feel like they are expecting a lot for him, even for Jimmy to do what he did in the postseason last year again. Feels like a big ask, man. It's like, as fun as it was, like, are we counting on him putting up 56 in a game four again? Like, is that the strategy? I don't know. I promise you, if it was like any other team than the Knicks, I'd be doing the same thing. I promise you, Dan.
I don't believe you, but I'll take you at your word as best I can. You mentioned those two names, Rozier and Bojan Bogdanovic, and those are guys where veteran players have been in playoff series, have been in big games, do feel like they would make a ton of sense in that structure in Miami. But yeah, you're right. Finding kind of like the, what's the package And it feels like, you know, the answer a lot of times is like that Lowry contract and a pick, or, you know, what can you sort of get together to find that upgrade? And then understanding, as we mentioned, the current structure that they've had has worked surprisingly well, given the constraints and how many guys have been in and out. So, but yeah, I think I get where you're coming from, and I am still going to engage coward mode and say that I am not counting the Heat out ahead of schedule. Well, I will need to see them, you know, dead and buried before I throw the last handful of dirt on them. So we've each picked a couple. We've each gone back and forth a little bit here. Is any other team from that group that you find particularly interesting, or a straight thought, a straight take you want to throw out before we move on?
Just shout out to Cleveland for battling after all the injuries, man. Like, I think a lot of people immediately pivot to Donovan Mitchell trade rumors after Garland got hurt. Mobley got hurt. They've stayed in the mix. And I'm just impressed with what they've done. You know, guys like Dean Wade have stepped up, and I think a lot of people assume they'd fall off immediately. Staying afloat without Garland and Mobley is pretty impressive.
Absolutely. 8-3 since December 15th, top 10 on both sides of the court. And one big thing for them, like, I caught them before the season in what is now an absolutely cursed story, because I was writing about Darius Garland, and then he's gotten like 9 different injuries right. since then, and the story will never see the light of day. But one of the things that JB Bickerstaff had talked about at that point, and that Garland and some other guys were talking about, was that they wanted to try to get, you know, more pace and more threes up, like everybody talks about in the preseason. And, you know, like, we're going to play faster, we're going to get more shots up, whatever, whatever. They've actually done it in this stretch, in part because they, like, kind of needed to find other ways to goose the offense. First 25 games, they were taking 33 threes per game. These last 11 games, it's up near 43. And so, and that's, as you mentioned, Dean Wade being a part of that. Caris LeVert has been great for them off the bench. Sam Merrill, kind of out of nowhere, has been a helpful player for them. But the big thing, Jared Allen, you know, we often talk about the, you know, how complementary are their front court and back court, where you've got two, you know, multi-talented, very skilled big men and two multi-talented, very skilled small guards. And, like, they obviously, they won, I think, was it 52 games last year? They had one of the best net ratings in the league. Like, it can work on a broad scale, but, like, are they also, you know, at some points, might it be better to separate those guys out? And, like, if you had one primary ball handling guard and then one screen and roll big, like, might that, you know, ease things up? And what Jared Allen has sort of suggested to these last, or at least reminded people in the last month here, is I'm capable of doing pretty big things with that. I was an all-star before we got Evan Mobley, over 19 points and 13 rebounds a game, shooting 67% from the field, 4 assists a game in this stretch. Like,
that block on
Wemby,
guy
who can do a lot. That incredible block on Wembanyama. Yeah, like, one of the best rim protectors in the league when he's got, you know, got that sort of responsibility for guarding the yard. So, like, you're absolutely right. Shouts out to them for keeping themselves afloat. They're going to have a new slate of things to, or I guess not new, like the same things to try to figure out when they get those guys back healthy again. But the fact that they actually, like, that's going to be an issue for them to resolve because they've been doing so well speaks well to how, you know, how JB Bickerstaff's been able to rally the troops there for sure.
Real quick,
I just wanted
to add, because I looked it up real quick, that the new starting five of Donovan Mitchell, Jared Allen, Max Strus, Dean Wade, and Isaac Okoro, they can't defend, really. It's like a 121.1 defensive rating, but a 123.4 offensive rating, just in 106 minutes, shooting the heck out of the ball. So it's been fun.
That's very, very fair. It's crazy to me. The last one I'll do, and then we'll move off of this. I'm watching Sacramento, and I kind of feel like I don't know. I look at them, and I'm like, "What are you?" It's like the reverse of what I'm saying with Miami. Like 21-14, but outscored on the season, point differential of like a sub 500 team. I mentioned earlier, dunks and threes with their adjusted net ratings, like, has them closer to like the 10th seed in the West than top four. You know, Fox and Sabonis putting up great numbers. Keegan Murray step forward. Malik Monk, maybe the best ball of his career. But it does just feel a little bit like there's not as much there. And then to have all the stuff that happened last week, where it's like, oh, well, they're shopping. Jake reported when we talked on No Cap Room, like, they're shopping, seeing what they could get with the Harrison Barnes, Kevin Herter package, and then the immediate conversation of like, oh, well, that's like basically a match for Siakam. And then the conversation going immediately to like, they're in Sacramento. Siakam is there. They're interested. No, they're out. And it's like, well, what if, and then like Siakam gives an interview to the Sacramento Bee where it's like, yeah, it's kind of weird. This is all going on. Like, it just feels like it's weird there. And I'm not exactly sure if it's good, weird or bad, weird, but weird and weird feels like it bears watching.
For sure. They don't have the same exact vibe that they had last year. And I think the West is so much more competitive at the top this year that it's made things a little bit more difficult for them. Yeah, they're going to be interesting to watch. I mean, the Keegan Murray conversation, that's a difficult one because I love him as a player. He's been so fun to watch. And, you know, he came in with all these aspersions, for lack of a better phrase. Like, why did the Kings pick him? The Kings messed up again, blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know, he's a big part of their playoff run. But how do you weigh the idea of keeping him and thinking about the player he could become or using him in a trade package? You know, I think there was a report that Siakam maybe wouldn't want to re-sign in Sacramento, which maybe cooled some of the trade talks there. But yeah, man, they're an interesting team. And then on top of all that, they have the question of, we saw what the Warriors did to Sabonis in the playoffs last year, and that's hanging over Sabonis' head, even if they do make it back in. So they're in an interesting place, but I like that they are at least attempting to be aggressive, attempting to improve. And I do think it's smart to kind of shop that Barnes and Herter package and see if that gets them anywhere.
Well, where we're going from here is not going to require any packages of players and picks. We're going to something that we call the closing five. As I'm sure you know, Rohan, you're a certified ball knower. How you start is not nearly as important as how you finish. We finish with five questions. Here we go. Question the first. Back in September, after a summer of trade rumors and breathless sourced report drama ended with Damian Lillard in Milwaukee, you tweeted, "Just so glad this Dame stuff is over. I feel like the entire conversation around the NBA needs a hard reset." What did you mean by that?
Man, I got so tired of asset discussion and pick discussion, and like everyone turns into like, if this person sends this tweet, that means it came from this GM and this is what this general manager is doing. And it just, you know, that the Dame stuff in particular, I don't know if it's because like Heat fans are annoying on Twitter or what it is, or it just felt particularly exhausting this time. And I'm curious if you felt the same way, but it just felt so over the top. And, you know, the tribalism sometimes gets so extreme to the point where like people are just constantly throwing out these wild theories and trying to suss out agendas in a way that it's like truly like a what happened to the game I love moment, you know? And
yes.
And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people who kind of work in the trade rumor field. I mean, we both know Jake, like, you know, Jake's fighting an uphill battle, man. And he does a great job finding information in a very, very competitive part of our field that very few people traffic in for a reason. But there also gets to a point where, and for example, I don't think Jake is this person, which is something I really respect about him, but like, the constant like trickle of trade rumor news. It's like, I'm the kind of person who's like, just tell me when it's done. Like, tell me when it happens. And I just feel like it got so exhausting and over the top that I was like none of this is fun for me, you know?
No, I totally hear that. I think the combination of the Dame, you know, saga as it went forward and then the Harden conversation, like, all of it just got to the point where I get the general argument of transaction news drives interest, which then leads coverage and then, you know, indicates what sorts of things you should be writing about or talking about or analysis that you could have or hypotheticals and whatever. You know, everybody's been asked by an editor to write the like five fake trades about whoever. But I might be because we do this all the time and we are like, we have to be so plugged into it. Like I might sort of get more exhausted by it faster than, you know, your general fan who's thinking about it more like a, you know, fantasy basketball player being like, yeah, no, that would be cool to add that guy to that roster. And what would it look like or whatever? But yeah, the parts where it's like to satisfactorily follow the league, you need to have like the corkboard of a detective trying to solve a crime. And like, yeah, no, that report comes from that place, which is tied to that GM, is tied to that agency, right, is tied to this. And what it really means is X, Y, or Z. Some element of that is like, it is the way that the league runs. But like, that's one thing for teams and, you know, agents and whoever to operate that way. Like, if you're a fan, just want, yeah, I think I tend to lean more where you are. Like, let me know when it's happening or when it's not happening. But like the bit by bit, like treating it like the horse race kind of, I found that sort of exhausting and enervating over the summer. So I would agree with you that, you know, a hard reset, it makes some sense right up until my editor asks me to write about five trade destinations.
I just sometimes see I get that it's like the nature of Twitter, and maybe I'm being a complete idiot about this, but I want to see like fan bases arguing with each other on Twitter. I'm like, what are we like? Can we just all step outside, like go outside, like enjoy our summers, you know, like stop getting mad online at people you don't know. And like, just wait for this trade to happen. Like, it's just, it all gets so absurd to me, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I just, you know, as long as we're wishing for things, I'd like a fucking pony.
Yeah, yeah.
Question the second. Back in December, Rohan, you tweeted, quote, "I feel like me and Dua Lipa would crush a couple Taco Bell cravings boxes together." And I guess same question. What did you mean by that?
She just seems like someone who appreciates, you know, kind of a wide spectrum of cuisines. And, you know, not pretentious. And I think if her and I got together, you know, just maybe hit a Taco Bell cantina. So we're going a little bit above and beyond here.
Upscale.
Yeah, upscale, a couple margs, a couple of those Chalupa cravings boxes and see what happens. You know, I think there's no subtext to that tweet. It means exactly what it says.
It's all text.
I think her and I would just chop it up over a couple cravings boxes, you know.
I believe this is what they call setting an intention,
yes,
right? I'm putting it out into the universe and then we'll see what comes back to me.
Remember like a year or two ago when everyone found that like Olivia Munn tweet that's like, "John Mulaney, I hope you get the help that you're going through, like such a big fan," whatever. And then like, you know, obviously they ended up like having a child together and now dating. Like, yeah, I'm just putting it out there and we'll see what happens in the next couple years, you know?
Well, obviously, Dua Lipa, big fan of Divine Intervention. Ball's in your court. Let's link up with our man, Ro. Question number three. You mentioned him earlier. We've spoken on this show multiple times about Jimmy Butler seeming like a good hang. Mm-hmm. Talked about it with Katie Heindel. Talked about it with Michael Pina. When he served as the guest editor for Sports Illustrated's NBA season preview, you wrote the cover story on what makes Jimmy Butler the most interesting man in the NBA. What was your best Jimmy story from that reporting experience?
Oh, man. First of all, shout out to the real hero of that experience, Rodney, who is Jimmy's personal barista, who made me three different iced lattes in a 2-hour span. That was awesome. That was the highlight of the photo shoot for me. So shout out to Rodney. Man, what is the highlight? I think it's just, like the Jimmy that you see on TV or on media day, or like that trolley mischievous, he's got that glint in his eye. You know what I mean? Like, he's always ready to make some trouble. I think knowing that that's what he's always like is what was the highlight of that experience for me. It's that, like, we were sitting in a classroom in this Fort Lauderdale High School, and I was following him around the summer camp, and he had a little bit of a break. And, he's like, "How much time do we have?" And they're like, "Oh, like, you know, there's going to be a good break between your next event." And he looks at me and he's like, "You ready to do your interview now?" And I was like, "I was born ready, Jimmy." And he's like, "I hope you don't fuck this up." And so I was like, "This is what I do." Like, that's what he is. You know, he's challenging people. He's putting people on the spot. And I think that's what's really fun, man. He's just got this, I think, really fun attitude about him. It's weird. In a way, he almost is like similar to Nikola Jokic for me, in that they've like calibrated kind of the perfect level of seriousness to have, where it's they both are obviously great at their jobs, but know how to enjoy the things in life that they want to enjoy. And it was cool getting kind of witness that up close. Also watching him work out. I got to watch him work out for like, I don't know if it was like 90 minutes or 2 hours, but just watching him go through. I know like his work has become like a self-made myth on his part.
Sure.
But, you know, it's funny. It's like he had obviously he'd played through the finals. He had the ankle injury. He traveled all summer and he came back to Florida to do the summer camp. And this was like the second or third day of the camp. All morning he's meeting with sponsors and taking photos. He's like a different joke for every person taking a photo with him. Then he's playing one-on-one against the campers. And then after all that, he just goes to like the high school's practice gym and works out for like 2 hours in a row. And it's like, it's nothing fancy. It's him, one friend, one trainer, two basketballs. And he just goes through it. He's listening to country music and, like working up an incredible sweat. And that was cool to see. That was really cool to see. You don't get to see that a lot in our jobs. And, it's like reassuring in a way.
That does sound like a cool experience, but I'm going to pick up on the last thing that you said. Sub question. In that story, you wrote that Jimmy is working on a country music album for which he has co-written upward of 40 songs. Do you know if any of them have been recorded? Like, is this a real thing?
I was told that it's like a pretty real thing. He means business about it. I know everything it seems like he does is a bit, but like, if you tried to be like, this right. is a bit, he'll be like, how dare you tell me that's a bit? He is serious about his country music. I believe he's like, as you know, he's got like some famous friends. I think he's recorded with some pretty big names. I'm not entirely sure how much I'm allowed to say about that, but I was told it.
It's okay. Nobody's listening. Give it to me.
I was told it for a reason, and that's because Jimmy Butler is serious about it.
Fair enough. Yeah. I guess we wait with bated breath to find out, to hear the music, much like that long ago track that LeBron and KD recorded together during the lockout.
We'll have to just keep our ears peeled for that one. That. Wow, that was man, what a blogger time never forgets. That was.
Question number four. You are a native of Mumbai, but you grew up in South Florida and you are a Miami Dolphins fan. How would you describe your current emotional relationship to Tua Tagovailoa?
I love my sweet baby throwing Samoan, and I just want Tua to succeed. But where I'm at with Tua is I'm a fan of him as a person, and I think he's a good quarterback. But any person in this industry you talk to, Dan, you know, in sports, whether it's a coach or a player, as much as we all appreciate the process and what it takes to get there, at the end of the day, it's a results-based business. And I think that for Tua, in some of these big games, the results have not been there. So I'm pulling for him to succeed. I'm a fan of his. The last few Dolphins games, though, I think were a little bit of a referendum on who he's going to be in big games. And right now, he still has a lot to prove there. So I think for someone who's a, you know, capital T, capital D, to a defender for a long time, I think that, unfortunately, we're all starting to lose, not faith, but the questions are growing in terms of, can he be the guy to get your team over the top?
Well, we live in hope that he will beat the fraudulent allegations. We'll close out here. Question five. We're going to go back to social media. Back in last night, you tweeted, "Not sure anything in my life makes me feel more vulnerable than my letterbox diary." So I checked out your letterbox, and in your most recent review, you claim that the Predator, like from Predator, is overrated as a hunter. What the hell are you talking about?
Predator ain't played nobody. Dan.
he played?
Oh. Dan.
Okay.
Let's say I gave you...
Okay, fine.
Let's say I gave you, like, technology that, like, far exceeded the current technology we have. I gave you heat vision and the ability to go invisible. I think you could start fucking some shit up.
Murdering
people?
Yeah,
you could start fucking some shit up. I could drop you in the jungle with those advantages and you could start fucking some shit up. You wouldn't need to be like a weird, ugly looking alien. My issue with the Predator is they made the Predator too overpowered. Like, take away the invisibility and make them very like stealth able or something like that, and I'd be more impressed. Like, like, I think I wrote this in my Predator review, like, Harry Potter could do what the Predator is doing. You don't need to be the Predator to do what the Predator is doing. You just need to be invisible. Like, you just need Harry Potter's invisibility cloak and a wand, and you can do what the Predator is doing. So I think the Predator is not only a little bit overrated, they somehow lose every time, too. How about making a movie where the Predator wins just to reestablish some of the Predator's dominance here? Because you're giving the Predator like 6 or 7 built-in advantages, and you're telling me at the end of every single one of these, they still lose. So Predator is a little bit overrated. I think the Predator has too many built-in advantages. What you need to do is strip away some of the Predator's help, okay? Predator is too much help. Take away some of that. You know, get back to basics here and have the Predator actually win at the end of one of these movies, and I'll respect it as kind of this ultimate killing machine.
I just love Rohan Nadkarni does not respect the Predator. It's feel like a sentence that's going to live in my brain. Also, I feel like I can't not, after we get done with this, search for like Harry Potter Predator fan fiction. Yeah, but then I'm also very concerned.
That could open the door to some strange results.
Yeah, maybe I don't do that on the work computer. I don't know. Like, it feels like it could get weird fast. Well, this got weird fast. But we're going to go. Our last thing we do is a weekly recommendation. It does not have to be anything about basketball. Previous examples include like the show Reservation Dogs, going to the library, making baked ziti and Outshine popsicles. It can be about anything, just something that you think is cool and good you would like to recommend to the listenership. So, Rohan, anything that you would like to share with the people?
Not to fully back on kind of the baked ziti bit here, but, you know,
that's fine.
Something I'll say is, when you cook for someone you appreciate or cook for someone you love, I think sometimes people wrap that up in, this has to be so good, this has to be brilliant, I'm cooking for someone. But what they overlook is that gesture to me is so meaningful, that you took time out of your day, that you made the extra effort, that even if you are like not confident in yourself as a cook, or you think you always mess something up, that is always far outweighed by the beauty of doing something like that for someone. It's so intimate. I can understand that it feels vulnerable for people, but that's my recommendation, man. As someone who, that I feel like that's like my love language, is like cooking for someone who I appreciate in my life. That's the way I like to show them appreciation. That doesn't mean I'm great at it. That doesn't mean that everything I make is the most delicious thing ever. But I think just taking that effort, taking that step, doing that for someone goes such a long way. Like, you know, Dan, if a friend of yours like just was like, hey, you know what? I baked some Toll House cookies that I bought at the grocery store and brought them to you. Wouldn't you be touched? You wouldn't care that they weren't like homemade, artisan, fresh baked cookies. You'd be like, this is so beautiful that someone did that for me. So, you know, we're starting a new year here. Just so show some appreciation for someone in your life. You know, go out of your comfort zone a little bit.
I love that. That is incredibly sweet. You're absolutely right. I actually get in trouble sometimes because my wife is like, you're not critical enough. Like, I'm just so grateful that she made something. Like when, you know, when we have those interactions, and I'm like, it's so cool that you did that. She's like, no, it didn't come out the way it's supposed to. I'm like, it came out. Like, yes, you made a thing for me. What a nice thing.
There's sustenance for me to live on here now. Like,
yes. I love that. I love it as a way of viewing intimacy and interactions with your friends and your family and the beloved ones. I love that. Mine is, listen, my recommendation this week, I will grant, I'm stipulating up top, I'm aware of how washed this is, all right? But I've got to live my truth. My weekly recommendation is going to sleep early sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Because listen, NBA games happen at night, and I have children who I have to help get ready for school every morning. And so oftentimes my answer to that is I just don't sleep very much. I am like way over caffeinated, maybe not 3 iced lattes in 2 hours over caffeinated, but like very over caffeinated, very underslept. And as a result of that, very irritable and maybe not like the best parent or partner. And I just sort of respond to that by being like, well, I guess that's the way I need to feel because of my job and the demands of my family. And also because I don't deserve to feel better than this. And every once in a while, zagging and coming to the realization that like it's okay to miss some games and catch up on some sleep and then like catch up on the games in the morning or do your work a little bit early before everyone gets up, but like get that actual early night of sleep It is like, it is absolutely a restoration, like hitting the reset button on your body and your brain, to the point where like, it then makes me more angry after the fact, where I'm like, I always do this wrong. And then like the one or two times I do it right, I'm like, why do you always do this wrong? I'm not going to say necessarily, I'm not going to like go out on a limb and say, I'm going to do this all the time. And like, it's going to be my long-term life plan of sleeping from like 9 p.m. to 4 or 5 a.m. But I will say to you that this particular episode of Divine Intervention is brought to you by a 41-year-old man who listened to his body for a change and went to sleep early. And I'm sorry that you can't unhear the thing about me listening to my body, but I'd like to think that you hear the difference in the show, that the energy and the vibe is fueled by rest and relaxation, and that I've brought that to you today.
We need to normalize going to sleep at a normal hour in our profession, where it's like, it's all, yes, you know, I write at 3 a.m. and, you know, we've all done it, but we need to normalize, hey, I'm going to watch the West Coast game tomorrow morning. Let's just make it easy for everybody. Go to sleep when you need to go to sleep.
Listen, everybody, if there's one thing you take away from this episode, outside of the fact that the Predator ain't played nobody, it's that you should go to sleep at a normal time. Rohan, thank you so much for taking all this time for everything that you've done with us today here. Where can people find your work? Anything you'd like to point people toward on the way out the door? This is time for a ruthless plug, so go for it.
Yeah, find me on Letterboxd. Let's talk more money. Let's talk more movies. Let's talk, you know, more Predator. Hit me up on Letterboxd, Rohan Nadkarni on there. I don't know how it works. I'm still figuring it out. So also, if you have any tips for me, please let me know. But I'll, you know, but let's get vulnerable together on Letterboxd.
I love that. I love that so much. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. Thank you so much to Rohan Nadkarni for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with himself. Thank you so much to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great week after week. If you are listening to us on, or wherever you're listening to us, give us a 5-star review, rate, review, subscribe, let everybody know that we're doing a good thing here and that you enjoy it. It helps us with discoverability and growing the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.